The Frontline Dispatch is made possible by the Abrams Foundation, committed to excellence in journalism, and by the Frontline Journalism Fund, with major support from John and Joanne Hagler.
Support for Frontline Dispatch comes from the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, dedicated to providing the latest therapies and cancer specialists who are experienced in your cancer. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
Hi, Dispatch fans. Rainey Aronson here, executive producer of Frontline. Today, I'm excited to share an episode of a new podcast from our friends down the hall here at GBH, the science series Nova. Nova Now is a new biweekly podcast diving into the science behind the headlines. Join host Alok Patel behind the scenes with scientists, engineers, technologists, mathematicians, and more working to better understand our world. It's more critical than ever to distinguish fact from fiction and find science-based answers to the most pressing questions of our time. Enjoy this episode of Nova Now.
How's it going, everyone? Not sure if you noticed, but it's already September. We're probably thinking about schools reopening, fall sports, maybe getting back to business. But hold on. We're 6 months into a pandemic. It's still happening.
The virus is winning and the American people are losing.
After a second grade student tested positive within the first
COVID-19 hospitalizations.
And in the parts of the country where the coronavirus is spreading, one of the biggest holdups right now is testing.
How are you going to test?
Involving COVID-19 testing.
Testing is going to be the key to opening.
When it comes to reopening the economy and getting schools back in session.
Let's open up.
They need to be in school. They need to be learning.
Experts agree we need a faster, more efficient, and more available coronavirus test.
Robust and more rapid testing.
Why can't we figure this out?
So today on the show, we're going to talk about how a gene editing tool called CRISPR might be able to revolutionize diagnostic testing.
I don't think I realized how crazy the journey would be.
But the question is, will it be ready for prime time during this pandemic?
It's really Hail Mary time.
This is Nova Now, where we dive into the science behind the headlines. I'm Alok Patel. For starters, I want to get a primer on testing from someone who really knows her stuff. Dr. Butler Wu, what is it that you do?
Okay, I am a board-certified clinical microbiologist.
Susan Butler Wu runs the testing lab for the LA County University of Southern California Medical Center, one of the biggest public hospitals in the U.S.
So my role is to essentially oversee diagnostic testing for infectious diseases.
You are so needed right now because I don't think anyone's ever seen so much public dialogue about testing, things that are right, things that are wrong, completely misunderstood. So I just wanted to ask you if you were to do a bird's eye view of diagnostic testing right now regarding this coronavirus, what your thoughts are, what are we doing well, what are we not doing well?
I have to use my appropriate language here, but if we were having adult beverages, I might be more colorful with my language. There's a lot that's wrong right now because we essentially are dealing with a pandemic in the absence of any national strategy for testing. Essentially, every person like me has to fight to get what they need for their own lab, for their own institution to do testing. And that's part of the problem.
You know, the other week I had to get a test. I had an exposure at the hospital. And it is surprising how difficult it was to get a test result back within 2 or 3 days. Most of the places I talked to were very open, saying, 5 to 7 days. One place even said up to 14 days, which at that point, that's pretty much useless.
Yeah, it's completely useless. That's why people are starting to think about things like antigen testing, just to be able to give something rapid back to people. But the problem is that there's limitations with every type of test, and people don't understand those limitations. Let's call it what it is. It's a bloody disgrace. You're a healthcare worker, and you need a rapid test, and you couldn't get one.
All right, so I want to break down a couple terms we'll be hearing a lot. PCR testing and antigen testing. These are tests to see if you have the virus in your system right now. Not to be confused with antibody testing, which is looking for a previous infection. When a healthcare worker sticks a swab up your nose for a sample, they're most certainly running one of these two tests. And if they're not, you should probably ask them what they're doing with that swab, because it sounds shady. But let's start with the PCR. What you need to know is that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, has a genetic signature we can detect. It's made of RNA, or ribonucleic acid.
So, you know, if you Google coronavirus and you see these cute little pictures that look like little buckyballs, like that's the actual virus. And so inside the virus is the RNA. So it's surrounded by protein and other constituents. So we have to basically crack that open.
And once you crack open that tiny ball of a virus, you can identify the coronavirus RNA itself. This is the beauty of PCR.
When we talk about COVID testing, that is predominantly what we've been talking about. And that's looking for the RNA from the virus. So what are some of the pros and what are the cons? The pros, from a diagnostic testing perspective, it is the most sensitive test.
In other words, if you have the virus, a PCR test is probably going to find it.
Some of the cons are, obviously, as we've seen borne out, is that you need specialized equipment. You need to extract the nucleic acid out of the cell. You need to amplify it. You need to do all that stuff. And that's where the major con is now evident, as we are now months and months and months into this, and we're in a huge country needing a lot of testing, that's the major con, actually.
Basically, to do PCR testing, you need all the right equipment, and right now, there's just not enough of that to go around. But there is an alternative.
So for the antigen testing, the major advantage, the major pro, is that it's something that can be performed in a doctor's office or a clinic. It decentralizes it, so that's a huge advantage.
The reason antigen testing is easier to do is that you're not testing for the virus's genetic material at all. An antigen is a foreign substance that causes an immune response. In this case, that foreign substance is a little protein that's made by the virus. So it's like finding mouse poop all over your basement and realizing you've probably got an infestation. Much simpler and faster than looking for the actual mice. Also, I really hope you don't have mouse poop all over your basement.
The other advantage is it's very fast because it's basically the results are back in 15 minutes, 15, 20 minutes. But the major disadvantage is with respect to sensitivity.
Meaning it will miss the virus sometimes.
And also with regard to specificity.
Meaning you'll also get false alarms on people who don't have the virus.
So the governor of Ohio basically had a false positive result. That was with an antigen. There's been clusters of sort of pseudo outbreaks of false positive antigen tests on the East Coast. So those are the main differences.
Just to sum it all up, PCR testing is accurate, but requires a bunch of special lab equipment. Antigen testing, on the other hand, is easy and fast, but not always as accurate. Why, you might ask, can't we come up with a test that combines the best of both? I'm talking about the holy grail here, the cronut of viral diagnostics, the chicken and waffle combo that's both sweet and salty, fast, easy, accurate, delicious. Could it be possible? That's what we're about to find out. The story involves a fancy piece of genetic technology called CRISPR. We'll get to that in a moment. But first,
yeah, it's gone.
Let's meet Sounds the beat. Scientific dynamic duo.
I hope the sound in there is good.
Of Omar Abudeya and Jonathan Gutenberg.
Science can be kind of a lonely pursuit sometimes.
This is Jonathan.
And to have someone else, you know, with you, I think really adds to a lot of great synergies, which is why, you know, there's been a lot of cool scientific duos in the past. You know, it's fun to do something together.
If you guys come up with a cool duo name, you're going to be like Jonathan Omar or like Jomar?
We've, there's been a lot of input from other parties into that matter.
And this is Omar.
You know, Jomar has been the popular one. OJ, there's...
I don't know about OJ. I like Jomar better. This pair, I wish I could just sit in a bar so I could just watch them nerd out and banter.
The lab's Abudeya Gutenberg, which we shortened to Abugut.
Abugut sounds like a wedding hashtag.
Yeah.
Abugut. Abugut.
Yeah.
Abugut. Okay, so Jonathan and Omar actually met in college. They both went to MIT.
He was like that kid in class who would just have like all this random information about like biology. He was a gold medalist and sort of the biology Olympiad. So I knew Omar is a pretty intense guy. You know, I think people like that are drawn together.
They end up in this class together.
Yeah, course 20, biological engineering.
And get paired up on a project.
Because I was like, we're going to finally kill this project and like get a really good grade, I guess.
They finished up that project and then went their separate ways. But fate was not finished with Omar and Jonathan, better known as Jomar.
So at about that time, there were these early papers coming out on this like cool new tool like for CRISPR.
C-R-I-S-P-R, CRISPR.
CRISPR had like just come out. And I was immediately drawn to it. I really wanted to be part of it.
And so when they start grad school at MIT, Jonathan and Omar both join the same lab.
I was like, I gotta be in the lab.
The lab was run by Feng Zhang, one of the scientists who pioneered the use of this gene editing technology called CRISPR.
We were lucky to be at this epicenter when it was just like erupting.
So here's what you need to know about CRISPR. It's a gene editing technology. It uses a protein originally found in bacteria called Cas9, which works like a pair of scissors. Those scissors can then be programmed to identify and cut small pieces of genetic material, meaning DNA or RNA. It basically opened the floodgates on gene editing. It was a huge deal. Now, around this time, in 2015, everyone is talking about using CRISPR to do things like treat genetic diseases, create genetically modified crops, stuff like that.
This is where like I reunited with Jonathan and we would brainstorm crazy ideas about like how to make large deletions in the genomes of cells to study like.
But as new grad students, our friends Jomar are basically free to play around with this technology.
Stitching two proteins together, one at like
just to see what else might be possible.
Inserting large pieces of DNA. It was just like a whirlwind.
What, like, tell me about the aha moment when you were like, whoa, we can actually use this to diagnose and identify viruses.
Yeah, so we were really kind of exploring this protein, which back then was called C2C2. It's been renamed to Cas13 now.
Now, remember how I said CRISPR uses a protein called Cas9 to cut DNA? Well, our friends Jonathan and Omar here are playing around with a slightly different protein called Cas13.
And it was like a really peculiar protein because, for one thing, we found out kind of early on in that process that instead of cutting DNA like Cas9 does, it cuts RNA.
RNA, like what the coronavirus has. That will matter in a minute. But there was something else going on with Cas13.
When you want to cut a piece of, you know, DNA or RNA with scissors, you expect it to break into two clean pieces, which is what happens when you cut stuff with Cas9. But with this protein, it was pretty funky because we were getting like a bunch of different cuts. We were like, man, this is getting chewed up.
So it's almost like Cas9 is this pair of scissors designed to cut things, but then Cas13 is like a toddler with scissors who's going to run around and be like, cut, 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 and just go haywire, but haywire in a programmed fashion.
Yeah. So we were thinking, hey, maybe this isn't cutting right where we tell it to cut, but it's actually cutting in a totally different way. That's when we kind of stumbled on this property of the enzyme, which we call the collateral effect.
The collateral effect.
So the idea is that if you tell it to cut this one piece of RNA, in this case, it'll cut it. But it'll also start cutting other things in the solution, other RNA. Then we ran this really neat experiment where we could put one piece of RNA in that we told it to cut, and it would cut that RNA. And we could put another piece of RNA in, but this is the weird thing. It would also cut the second piece of RNA. So it was like this activated cutting. It's like, you know, almost it flipped a switch when it hit that first piece and it was like, I'm gonna cut up everything. And so we thought, hey, this is cool. If the first piece of RNA is like a virus and the second piece of RNA is like something that we can see, like something you can detect using a machine, then if that virus is there, it'll cut the second piece too.
The key here is that this second cut, the collateral cut, can be detected. So if the target RNA, say from a tiny virus, is present, then Cas 13 will start cutting a bunch of other stuff. And that stuff will literally emit a signal, like a kind of light that we can then detect.
And that's kind of when we're like, man, we can really use this for detecting nucleic acids and diseases and viruses and everything.
Omar, so picking up from there, like after you guys were like, hey, we got this pair of scissors that's going to go nuts and identify, you know, multiple pieces of RNA, what was the next step?
I remember we, I think like on a whiteboard, like mapped out different diagnostic areas. Like we could like go into it, like, you know, we should try to detect bacteria. Like we should try to do virus detection. We should try to do like cell-free cancer detection. We should try to like see.
They tried Zika samples, antibiotic resistant bacteria.
We should try to see if we can do.
Basically whatever they could get their hands on.
All these different applications. It was like, you know, just kids in the candy shop. We were like, oh, let's try it on this. Let's try it on this. Let's try it on this.
The whole process was actually pretty simple, simple in air quotes, once they got the hang of it. And with a little bit of refining, it might even be simple enough for the average person to do at home.
I think that's like been one of the coolest developments is like, you know, trying to transform these things into like the simplest user format so you can try to push this stuff out of, you know, complex labs and hospitals and getting closer to maybe people's homes down the road.
All right, let's bring all this back down to earth. Remember, we're looking for a fast, easy, accurate way to test for a virus. And that's exactly what Omar and Jonathan were getting at with this new CRISPR system. Well, they were missing one thing, and that's an awesome razzle-dazzle acronym.
Yeah, I mean, we called the technology Sherlock in this 2017 paper in Science. And
wait, remind me what Sherlock stands for.
Oh, man, on the spot. So it's specific high-sensitivity enzymatic reporter unlocking.
Specific high-sensitivity enzymatic reporter unlocking. And that's how you get to Sherlock.
But it basically comes down to the fact that it's a system that's incredibly specific, incredibly sensitive. So, yeah, I mean, I think the acronym holds up pretty well.
So the paper is published in 2017. The next year, Omar, Jonathan, their advisor Feng Zhang, and some other colleagues get together and create a biotech company called, drumroll please, Sherlock Biosciences, with a basic goal of creating CRISPR-based diagnostics for the healthcare industry.
And we brought in an amazing team, and we were like, you know, let's turn this into something real.
Now, when you created Sherlock, and you're already thinking about all these applications, you've got multiple papers about, you know, where can we take this? And then we hit a pandemic. How soon did you realize, like, hey, we could actually be game changers here right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think in January, you know, we started getting a lot of messages. And we're like, this is crazy. Like, we should maybe, like, do something. We have a technology here. Why don't we develop a test for COVID? And we finally were like, let's just do it.
In just a few weeks, they had a working test kit.
And it got a significant amount of interest. We started sending out kits all over the world for free to, you know, clinicians, researchers who wanted to like work with it and develop it.
Now, these early kits were not approved for clinical use. So scientists were just testing the technology to see if it worked, which it did. But getting it approved by the FDA and actually using it in hospitals and clinics, well, that would take more than a few scientists with a really cool acronym.
You know, we felt it was important to bring this technology to bear in the fight against COVID-19. And we do see Sherlock as part of the solution.
That's after the break. It's February 2020. COVID-19 is exploding in Europe, and it's about to explode in the United States. But Sherlock is on the case.
I joined the company in January of 2019.
William Blake is the chief technology officer of Sherlock Biosciences.
And as the pandemic started kind of coming to the fore, the team effectively dropped everything. At the time, things were shutting down. Quarantine was in effect here in Massachusetts. But the reality is that we were developing a test and we needed to develop in a lab. It's not something you can do at home. You know, the team really came together and moved toward developing the first authorized use of CRISPR in the clinic, our CRISPR SARS-CoV-2 test kit.
So what Sherlock got is technically called emergency use authorization, meaning the FDA hasn't fully reviewed the test, but they're allowing it to be used anyway. And this is huge because it's the first ever CRISPR-based diagnostic test that's been approved for clinical use.
You have an incredibly specific, sensitive test that provides results in about an hour using equipment that's fairly common in a lot of testing labs.
Now, do you envision you guys will be able to kind of revolutionize the point of care testing? And, you know, for our listeners out there, point of care is just like getting a strep test at the doctor. You get the test within 20 to 30 minutes. Do you envision that with Sherlock?
Absolutely. We've recently announced a partnership with Binx Health, and they've developed an instrument that enables point of care testing, you know, effectively a desktop size instrument with a cartridge. So sample goes in, it's fully automated, and a detected or not detected answer comes out.
Basically, this company, Binx Health, has a device that's already used in tests for chlamydia and gonorrhea. The idea is you take that device, which is about the size of a rice cooker, and outfit it with Sherlock's new CRISPR technology. If it works, that would mean no test tubes, no lab equipment. Just take a nasal swab and stick it in the machine for a fast, accurate result. It all sounds pretty promising. And I should add, pretty profitable as well, because let's be real, diagnostics are a huge medical business. But before we get too carried away, let's take all this back to our expert consultant. Susan Butler Wu, do you buy the hype?
I guess I'm cautiously optimistic about the hype. I mean, it's such a cool system, right? Just the whole way it works is fascinating.
It's like science fiction.
It really is. It's like, I love science so much. yay. So I think in terms of the ability to essentially not need all of this, you know, equipment, that has enormous potential. What it is going to take is that somebody who takes that technology and operationalizes it to make it foolproof. That's what you need in the point of care, because a lot of these like proof of principle studies look awesome, but they're based on having to open up a tube and then stick in something or move it. And that's the kiss of death for a point of care test, particularly when tests are not being run by people who have expertise in pipetting and molecular techniques.
This is where that device comes in, the one you can just stick a swab in for a quick result. If that device really proves to be reliable and easy to use, this problem could be solved.
So I think it has the potential to really be game-changing. For sure. I don't like to use that term because we're all just game-changed out at this point. But like, I do think it has enormous potential there. It just, that first piece is the part that needs to be kind of gotten past.
I'm just imagining this company making a point-of-care test and being excited, and then having Dr. Butler Wu show up and being like, this part is the kiss of death. And there is one other possible hang-up for the Sherlock test.
There's so many problems in the supply chain right now. And unfortunately, with the CRISPR assays that, you know, people are working on that have been described, they're still dependent on one bottleneck for the most part, which is still the nucleic acid extraction piece. Essentially, nucleic acid-based technologies require you to have the nucleic acid. So that's, you know, the genome of the virus. And so the kits that you would use to crack open those little buckyballs to pull out the genome to now do the testing, there have been shortages with.
So even though the Sherlock test is way simpler to run than PCR, it depends on some of the same basic ingredients, which could lead to the same supply chain bottleneck. But at the end of the day, if the test works, if it's fast and efficient, Susan Butler Wu is on board.
Things like this have enormous potential in terms of getting out into the places where they don't have access to anything within 24 hours. Because really, when you get out to 2 to 3 days waiting for results and beyond, it's worthless. But I don't think it's a replacement for anything. I think it's just an addition to the repertoire, if you will. It really is. I think I said this to me before. It's really Hail Mary time. Like, there's just not enough of anything right now.
Just a few weeks ago, Dartmouth Hitchcock Health announced that they were running a study of the Sherlock test using samples from their member hospitals in New Hampshire and Vermont. The healthcare network released initial data from that study earlier this month,
which showed that Sherlock's CRISPR-based test gave the same result as a standard PCR test in 100% of the samples. That's a good sign in terms of accuracy. But keep in mind that this is still being run on a small scale and in a really well-equipped laboratory. As Susan Butler Wu said, getting this technology out to local schools and small clinics where it's needed most will bring a whole new set of challenges. Meanwhile, on the West Coast, another company called Mammoth Biosciences is also working on a CRISPR-based diagnostic for the coronavirus, with support from the National Institutes of Health. So the race is on, but for now, it remains to be seen whether CRISPR-based testing can be that alternative we need right now. The Hail Mary pass, the fourth quarter buzzer beater, the walk-off home run we've been waiting for. I know you want to know more about CRISPR gene editing technology, how it was discovered, how it works, and the potential it presents for humanity. Well, you're in luck. Nova is streaming the feature documentary special, Human Nature, that explores all of this. And then, if you want to know even more about CRISPR, I personally had the pleasure of getting to meet with scientists at the cutting edge of CRISPR science. Get it? For a short Nova documentary on how CRISPR is being used today in the real world. Spoiler alert, I may or may not have had to stick my arm up a cow's butt. And if you want to know why, you've got to watch. That's Gene Editing Reality Check, and you can watch that in the feature doc Human Nature at pbs.org/Nova and on the PBS video app. Nova Now is a production of WGBH and PRX. It's produced by Ian Koss, Ari Daniel, Jocelyn Gonzalez, Isabel Hibbard, Christina Monin, Sandra Lopez-Monsalve, and Nina Porzuki.
You guys thought about who's going to play you in the movie? The movie about you two?
Seth Rogen, maybe. I don't know.
I'd be down for Rami from Rami.
Seth Rogen and Rami doing a movie about genetic engineering.
Julia Court and Chris Schmidt are the co-executive producers of Nova. Dante Graves is director of audience development. Suki Bennett is digital editor, and Robin Kasmer is science editor. Our theme music is by the legendary Kid Koala. I'm Alok Patel. We'll see you back in 2 weeks, which hopefully is no longer how long it takes to get a COVID test result back. What is one song that you can play? It can be any song you want that gets Dr. Butler Wu just fired up to get to work and to make some amazing science.
This is, I don't play this very often, but like if I need to be like, yeah, I'm just going to get pumped up. It's
oh,
like,
it's a secret weapon.
It's like 50 Cent in the Club. Oh. Because I just like the whole beat. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Go Shody. It's your birthday.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to party while you're just pipetting. You can find me in the club. Bottle full of, I can't sing this song or I'll get fired. Go Shody. For everyone who now listens to 50 Cent Indie Club, I hope you hear that song and you think about PCR testing and the pros and cons of antigen testing and the unknowns of CRISPR-based testing.
Dr. Patel, I'm afraid I may have ruined that song now for lots
I think you improved
people.
It. I think 50 Cent's going to get a huge paycheck now from people downloading that single.